This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy. Guns can of course be lethal, and frequently are, but the same can be said about cars. Is there a better argument for controlling private ownership of guns than there is for cars? Many law-abiding Americans believe that they have a moral right to own firearms, even automatics. Jeff McMahon, like most philosophers, denies this. No surprises there. But he believes that philosophers should take the trouble to show the gun lobby why they're wrong. Philosophy Bites examines the calibre of his arguments.
Jeff McMahon, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you.
The topic we're talking about today is gun control. Now, I guess the most trivial reason people give for wanting to own guns is for sporting purposes. They want to hunt, they want to shoot targets.
That's right, and I think that's a major motivation of most of the grassroots supporters of the National Rifle Association in the United States. In my view, these are not very strong reasons for recognizing a right of private gun ownership. Two reasons for that. One is that target shooting in ranges and clay pigeon shooting with shotguns and so on can be done without private ownership of guns. That is, the places where one can go and shoot targets or shoot clay pigeons could have the types of guns that are needed for that kind of activity there for rent at the facility under conditions of security. It's a different matter in the case of hunting animals in the wild for sport. But if it's right that having lots of guns in the country actually imperils the personal security of large numbers of people, then it seems to me that the trade-off between the pleasure that people get from hunting and the security of other human beings in the society goes very much in favor of personal security of persons. It's, in my view, rather hard to argue for a moral right to gun ownership on the basis of the pleasure that people get from killing other sentient beings. I used to do it myself. I grew up as a hunter. I know the pleasure of hunting. But we have to recognize the intrinsic character of what's being done when people hunt for sport. They are actually going out and sending pellets of metal ripping through the bodies of sentient creatures who don't really threaten anybody. And that's hardly a kind of morally privileged or protected activity, in my view.
But people do think they have a moral right to guns. They think they have a moral right to self-defense.
That's right. The main argument, I think, for gun possession in the United States appeals to the right of individual self-defense. And what sophisticated defenders of gun rights claim is that if the state prohibits private gun ownership or drastically restricts private gun ownership, they are actually, by depriving people of perhaps the most effective means of self-defense, violating people's fundamental right of self-defense. So sometimes gun advocates give the following analogy. They say that gun prohibition or restrictive gun control is analogous to taking away someone's gun just as they are about to be killed by a murderer, thereby rendering them defenseless. And clearly we think that's wrong. That is, if you're about to be murdered and you have a gun and you can use it to save yourself, but somebody takes your gun away from you or holds your hands behind your back so that you can't defend yourself, they are complicit in your murder.
So that sounds like quite a compelling argument.
Well, I don't think it is, actually. What's most fundamental here is not so much the right to self-defense, but the right to personal security. Now, if there is a right of gun ownership as a means of self-defense, it's a derivative right. The right to own a gun is derivative from the right of self-defense, because the right of self-defense implies a right to some means of self-defense, presumably, or at least that's what people say. But if I'm right that the right of self-defense is not fundamental, and the right of personal security is what's fundamental, then the right to own a gun is derivative from a right that is itself derivative from the right of personal security. And the real question then becomes whether gun possession on a kind of widespread basis, that is, if everybody has this right to self-defense and the means of self-defense, you're going to have a society in which lots of people have the means of self-defense, namely guns. If that's a society in which people are less secure personally than one in which they don't possess all these guns, then the most fundamental right, namely the right of personal security, is actually being violated by people's possession of guns rather than protected.
So the argument is that if each of us has the right, in inverted commas, to own a gun, then all of us are made less personally secure.
That's exactly right. You see it in the statistics comparing gun deaths in the United States with gun deaths in other countries. When large numbers of people are armed with guns, everyone's security declines. It's rather like a prisoner's dilemma in the sense that for a particular individual, it may well be true that he's going to be more secure having a gun than not having a gun, whatever is true of everybody else. But if he has a gun and it's a condition of his having a gun that everyone else can also have a gun, then everyone's going to have a gun and he's going to be less secure than he would be if he didn't have a gun and other people didn't have guns either.
Well, let me draw an analogy with transport. I think I have a right to get from A to B as quick as I can. That might involve having a car. If we all have cars, we'll all end up getting from A to B slower than, let's say, if there were just buses and trains. Are you then saying that we don't have a right to own a car?
No, I'm not saying that, though I can imagine circumstances in which that could be true. The argument you gave there was couched in terms of efficiency, and even though it's true that we would all be able to get where we need to go more efficiently if we all relied on public transport than if we rely on private transport, the value of efficiency isn't itself enough to deprive people of their right to have a car. Partly that's because there are other reasons for driving than just getting from A to B. Sometimes people want to go out and ride around on the single track roads and view the countryside. But more importantly, if private ownership of cars proved to be far, far deadlier to people than the use of public transportation only, then I can imagine a situation in which it would be right to deprive people of a legal right to own a car. We do restrict access to cars and driving. We insist that everyone get a driving license before they can drive. We take their driving privilege away if they have too many accidents or drink while they drive and that kind of thing. So it's no one thinks that there's a kind of natural right to own or drive a car. Now, cars are dangerous. A lot of people get killed in car accidents. But the difference there from the case of guns is that most of the people who are killed by cars are also themselves car drivers. So there's a sense in which by driving themselves, they consent at least implicitly to this practice. They accept the risk. They assume the risk of being killed when they drive their own car. Now, I think many of the people at least who get killed by firearms are not participants in this practice. That's a huge difference. I don't own a gun. I wouldn't own a gun. I don't want to have a gun. My security is reduced by people possessing guns. If I ever get killed by a gun, I won't be in any way implicitly consenting to this practice.
So you suggested that if there was legislation, as in the UK, on gun ownership, everybody in the United States would be safer. But at the moment, there isn't strict gun control in the United States. So it would seem rational for each individual to go and purchase a gun. So in those circumstances, why haven't you done that?
Well, the reason I haven't done it is that it's not clear to me that the claim that there's a prisoner's dilemma here is really true. It's not clear to me that I would actually be safer if I owned a gun. There are some statistics that suggest that when people get guns in their houses, they diminish their security because they may use those guns domestically, someone may take the gun away and use it against them. Someone may steal the gun from them. I don't want myself to make a contribution to this situation. Even if I personally would be more secure to have a gun in the house, I'm unwilling to increase my personal security in that way at the expense of other people's security. This is one way in which enough individuals who act contrary to their self-interest can resolve a prisoner's dilemma. And that's what I'm suggesting that we should do in advance of getting the kind of legislation that's necessary to break the prisoner's dilemma in the traditional way, that is by enforcing an agreement among people that they will all do what will make them collectively better off, even though each individual would do better, presumably in this case, by having a gun, whatever others do.
You often hear the argument in America, again, not in Europe, that people should have the right to have a gun because they're not just defending themselves against other individuals in society. They need to worry about the relationship between the individual and the state.
That's right. You hear this argument very often in the United States, and it is closely connected with the Second Amendment to our Constitution, which says that we need to have a well-regulated militia. There are two reasons why I think people thought that it was important for the United States to have a well-regulated militia. I'm talking about in the past now. One was that the United States didn't have a very effective regular army or professional army. So the United States, early on in its history, relied on a civilian militia for defense against foreign invasion. But the other reason that people thought that it was important to have a well-regulated militia was for defense against domestic tyranny. People thought that they'd just overthrown a tyrannical regime from overseas, and there was the worry that a homegrown variant of that kind of tyranny might spring up, and the best assurance against that was to have at least some people armed with muskets in their homes who could oppose whatever army the government could muster if the government became tyrannical. That's an absurd argument today. No band of private individuals in the United States is ever going to be any match for the army. People also tend to forget that if there are some people who are privately armed and believe that the government is behaving tyrannically, there are going to be other people who are privately armed who believe that the government is not behaving tyrannically. So what you're going to get is a kind of massacre among the civilian population. And that's no way to resolve disagreements within a society. We have a democracy in the United States today. We can resolve our political differences through democratic political processes. That's the civilized way to deal with these matters.
You often hear the cliche, it's not guns that kill people, people kill people. And it's true that you get other societies like Israel, Canada, Switzerland, which are saturated with guns, and you don't have anything like the number of deaths through firearm killings. So why not just attack the root causes, which are obviously cultural?
Well, there are a number of things to say about that. One is that attacking the root causes is very difficult. Nobody has a program for how to do that. How do you get Americans to be less violent? How do you get rid of the honor culture that prevails in parts of the United States? That's a very long-term enterprise. One way I do think that you can attack the cultural bases of the greater violence in the United States is, first of all, through gun regulation, gun control, and ideally, eventually, gun prohibition, or prohibition of private ownership of guns, because that's a practical way of expressing the social opposition to violence. If people are more violently disposed in the United States than they are in other countries, and I think Americans may be quite reluctant to concede that, but if that's true, they will succeed a lot better in being violent and killing people if they're all armed with guns than they would if they were not armed with guns. One illustration of this fact was pointed out by some commentators in the aftermath of the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. The man who went into the elementary school in Newtown with a gun killed 20 children, and he shot most of them several times. There were no survivors. But right around the same time, another man in China went after children with a knife, and he actually managed to stab 22 children, but they all survived. So that's an illustration of the difference between what happens when a deranged, violent person is armed with a gun and what happens when a deranged, violent individual is armed just with a knife or some form of weapon less effective than a gun.
These mass killings we get in America, they pop up with depressing regularity. You don't own a gun, but do you think everybody who's gone out and purchased a gun in America should feel some sense of moral responsibility for those dreadful events?
Well, let me begin by saying that the mass killings are only a tiny drop in the bucket of homicides with guns in the United States. But it does seem to me that people who own guns, and in particular people who advocate private possession of guns in the United States do bear some responsibility for all of this. And in a way, that seems obvious to me. That is, if we didn't have all these guns in the United States, we would have far, far fewer homicides. And we have all these guns in the United States only because people want to have them. We could have legislation prohibiting private ownership of guns and putting all guns in the hands of the police tomorrow if the gun advocates didn't oppose it. This is one thing that I think law-abiding gun owners and criminals are both complicit in. They both want access to guns. And the thing that I think is disturbing about gun owners who are not criminals is that they are willing to insist on their own private possession of guns at the cost of criminals having guns as well. That is, they would rather that they have them and criminals have them than that nobody have them. Because the idea that only law-abiding people are going to own guns in the United States and criminal types are not going to have them is, again, fantasy. So the cost of the gun owners being able to keep their guns is that criminals are going to have easy access to guns whenever they want them. However much of a background check you could do on somebody, if a person in the United States wants a gun and there's a gun in every other household, people are going to be able to get access to a gun if they really want it.
Gun control is a really fundamental issue in the United States, but it's odd that we don't have many philosophers talking about it. There aren't many articles about gun control, very few books about it. Do you have an explanation for that?
Debates that are dominated by empirical considerations just have a lot less cachet in the world of philosophy. But there are interesting philosophical issues in the debate about gun control. The problem is that they've appeared largely in the work of libertarian philosophers who are gun advocates. They have not tended to appear in the premier journals or by the most prestigious of philosophers. So within philosophy, it's very much a minor little debate going on in a tiny corner of the discipline. I think that this is an unfortunate state of affairs. Philosophers have devoted a lot of attention to other issues that seem to me to be morally less important, for example, capital punishment, where the number of deaths that can be attributable to the practice are far fewer than the deaths attributable to gun violence. But another factor is that apart from the libertarians, who are a fairly small minority within philosophy, most philosophers agree about guns, that we should have very tight restrictions or a prohibition. This is an area in which philosophers take a view that is quite different from that of the majority of the population in the United States. And so it's hard to generate a vigorous debate within philosophy. You're going to be preaching to the converted if you publish an article on this in one of the prestigious philosophy journals. But I think it's time that we end this situation, that philosophers take part in this debate, because there are some serious moral and philosophical issues in the debate about guns, and philosophers are the people who are best qualified to sort those issues out properly.
Jeff McMahon, thank you very much.
Thanks for this opportunity, Dave.
There are now two Philosophy Bites books published by Oxford University Press. Support Philosophy Bites and buy Philosophy Bites and Philosophy Bites Back. For more details, go to www.philosophybites.com.